Hi, friends. Welcome to the By Faith podcast. I am your host, Christine Hoover, and I'm so glad you're here. Each week this season, I'm talking with a guest about how they're using their unique gifts and talents in their specific context and season of life. My prayer for you is that by listening, you'll be encouraged, challenged, and equipped to step out by faith using your particular gifts for God's glory. Friends, I'm creating much more than this podcast. I do a little microblogging on Instagram, actual blogging on my website, and I do have a few books that I've put out into the world. In fact, I recently turned in my manuscript for my fifth book, and I'd love for you to follow along with me so you can hear more about it as the time comes. I can't wait to share it with you. You can find me on Instagram at ChristineHoover98 and all the books and all the things at my home online, gracecoversme.com. You can also always head there if you ever need a link to anything I mention in the show. This episode is sponsored by The Good Book Company, publisher of Goodbye to Goodbyes, the latest addition to their beautifully illustrated, award-winning Bible storybooks for children. In this vivid, moving, and exciting retelling of the story of Lazarus, Lauren Chandler helps children understand that Jesus came to say goodbye to goodbyes forever. For more information about Goodbye to Goodbyes, go to thegoodbook.com. Today, I've asked Wynn Collier to join me on By Faith to talk about the ministry of words. Wynn is pastor of All Souls here in Charlottesville, Virginia, so I've had the privilege of getting to know him in real life. He's also a writer, and in fact, when I was just getting started writing, or I should say, trying to get started, he helped me and encouraged me in such a meaningful way. Wynn and I talk about writing, how he got started, an exciting project he's working on currently, and what advice he would give to folks who want to write. We also talk about his ministry of words through preaching and pastoring people here in our city. I think you're going to like Wynn as much as I do and find his insights refreshing and encouraging. Here, friends, is my conversation with Wynn Collier. I'm super excited to get to welcome Wynn Collier to the podcast. Hi, Wynn.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. I mean, you're sitting across town. Fun fact, we both live in Charlottesville.
Yeah. We should be in the same room, shouldn't we?
I know. We're meeting up by computer. But you guys moved to Charlottesville the same time we did, probably the same month we did.
I think it was the same week.
August 2008.
It was at least within 4 or 5 days. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we moved like on the second or third and y'all were there 4 or 5 days later.
Yeah. And we both moved to plant a church in Charlottesville.
Yeah.
So tell us about your church. Tell us about you and your family.
Yeah. So, my wife is Miska. She is, we've been married for 21 years.
Wow.
And, is that right? Goodness. Yes. I'm pretty sure that's right. She's amazing. My best friend. She's a spiritual director, has been for about 15 years. She's also a yoga instructor and, she has helped me learn how to pray. So, I have two sons, Wyatt and Seth. Wyatt is a junior in high school and Seth is a freshman. And they love football. Wyatt loves lacrosse. They both play guitars. Wyatt just got a drum set for Christmas, which is down in our cellar. So, dear God, please help us.
Yes, that's what I was thinking. Yeah. Do they both play football for Charlottesville High School or what?
Yes, they do.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. And tell us about your church that you guys moved here to plant.
So it's All Souls, Charlottesville. And we are celebrating our 10th anniversary in January. I know you guys just recently celebrated yours. And so what to say? I feel like we're just a plain group of people. We trying to know how to follow Jesus and how to love our neighbors and I don't know what more to say.
I mean, that's what I would say, getting to watch y'all as a fellow laborer here in Charlottesville, that describes you well and your church. You are as Kyle would say, my husband would say, you are a mere pastor, that you love pastoring locally. Mm-hmm. And it shows in the way that you love and serve people in our community. So I think what you set out to plant has happened, and your church is making an impact in our community just by loving people well.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear. I'm glad I'm glad you see that.
Yeah. So are y'all going to do anything to celebrate the 10
year? We are. Yeah. There's a group that formed a dance party.
All right.
So we're going to have a dance party at a ballroom, and there's going to be an hour of dance lessons before the party, because I think there's a number of us that have no idea to do at a dance party. It's been a long time since we were in junior high. And then on Sunday, we're going to have just a big celebration and tell lots of stories. And then we're going to have a feast over at Cardinal Hall after church.
So, nice.
Yeah.
I hope that's a really special time for y'all. It was for us, just to get to reflect on 10 years. And sometimes I think, how did we get here? Who are these people? You know, sometimes
right.
I look around in church and I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm from Texas. Why am I living in Charlottesville, Virginia? But it's been a wonderful experience in heart.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So I feel like if I could, well, we haven't even mentioned that you write. You are a writer. You've published several books. Your last one is Love Big, Be Well, which was your first novel?
That's right. Yeah, that's correct.
So we'll talk about that in a second. But I just feel like when I think of Wynn Collier, I think of words. I think you are a person who cares deeply about words and being intentional with words, not only as a pastor, but as a writer. That comes across. Would you say that that's true about you, that you love words?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I honor them.
Yeah, and I mean, you live out what you live out these words. It's not just words to you, but I would love to know how words became important to you and why it's so important to you.
Yeah, I can't honestly say how. I think it's something that I more look back on and I realize, oh, this is true about me. And then I probably, from that vantage point, begin to think, why is that the case?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like most things. I think they actually happen to us. They're a grace, and then we discover it later. So I would definitely say that's true about words. But when I reflect on it, and I do, I care very deeply about words. And I think it's one of the things that saddens me the most about our cultural moment, is it seems like the meaning of words, the value of them, the beauty of them is being diminished. And they're often used as weapons as opposed to generative sparks of life. So I think what I encountered in words before I knew it is that words opened up realities to me, that they gave me a language for things I felt in my soul but was unable to articulate.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember even as a kid being absolutely lost in the world that Lewis created.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and it was more than just the stories. There was something about the language, the cadence, it just opened up a whole reality to me. I think as I moved into pastoring and thinking about preaching, I mean, the role of words became really important. I think not enough preachers take care with the words that they use and how they use them. I think the scriptures tell us they can be instruments of life or instruments of death.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly theologically, Jesus came to us as the word. Mm-hmm. And we probably don't have time right now to really unpack that, but there's something that's happening there in the person of Jesus. In the revelation of scripture, Jesus is offered to us as a living, active word. And I think that enlarges our entire human categories of words, and that something is happening and there's a capacity for creation, healing, hope, renewal, correction in life-giving words. And that's why it really saddens me when words are used in diminishing or narrow ways that don't allow the life-giving spirit to truly breed in them. So I think it's more of a hope is that in time, in bits and pieces here and there, that I would be given the opportunity to contribute to the work that so many are doing in trying to ennoble words and and use them for agents of creativity and goodness.
Mm-hmm. I think we're definitely, you said the cultural moment. This time, we are in some ways more in need of that. I think that we are ripe for or needing encouragement and hope and uplifting and unifying words rather than so much of what we're getting instead. And so I agree with you there. What are some of the words for you in your life that have kind of set your course, or you look back and you remember those specific words and who said them to you?
Is it okay if I say one more thing about what you just said?
Yeah, of course.
I do think it's very telling and interesting that we are probably have never been more a glut in words than we are now. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they're just everywhere. Yeah. You know, social media has done this to us, and yet they're devalued, it seems to me, more than they ever have been. So we don't even talk about that. I just think there's something to ponder there. But to answer your actual question, where my mind first goes is words that were spoken to me after I was engaged to Miska the first time. Long story, I won't bore you with it at the moment, but she ended up, because I was an idiot, she ended up handing the ring back to me. And I was having to deal with some of my own fears and issues. And a very wise elder man basically told me to buck up and be a man and get my courage on and treat Miska the way she deserved to be treated. And I grabbed that ring and drove 6 hours to Arkansas and begged and pleaded to get that ring back on her finger. But there was really something about the words that man spoke to me that maybe spoken at another time or to another person would have been harsh. But in that instance, it was very life-giving because it's what I needed. Mm-hmm. I think of my grandfather, who was the wisest man I knew growing up, as I was making some decisions that I think he could see were probably going to put me on a different trajectory in ministry than maybe would have been expected for me. He told me some wisdom about how to navigate that and how to learn when I needed to explain myself and when I didn't. I think that was very, certainly been lots of words and books that I've read that erupted in lots of places. But
was my next question. What about books? What are some maybe even sentences or thoughts that you go back to, especially when you're discouraged or you're needing to remind yourself of hope?
Well, that word hope is probably my favorite word. So I think I don't necessarily know that I go to them purposely thinking I need hope, so I'm going to go back there. But I think I inevitably find myself weaving my way back to places, I guess, subconsciously. I know that recently I've been spending a lot of time in Psalm 139. That psalm in an earlier season of my life was very meaningful when I felt very alone and isolated and consumed by my own fear and anxiety, and been through a recent season of that again. And so I've really been just meditating on Psalm 139. I find that powerful. If you ask me the same question tomorrow, I'm sure the litany would be different. But today, where my mind goes is, I think the opening couple paragraphs, pages of Peace Like a River is maybe one of the best openings of any book that's ever been written. Some of that may have been because of the courage demonstrated in the Father. That's something I needed to hear. When I get really adrift in what it means to be a pastor, I certainly return to Eugene
Peterson.
Yeah. I just find there's no other voice that is as clear and sane about pastoring, particularly in our time. So that probably was some of the sadness I felt when Eugene died. It was like, who else, you know, I don't know, like that voice was just gone. Even though it lives on. Marilynne Robinson, I just find her writing, I mean, her novels are beautiful, and I haven't read some of her most dense essays, but I do think some of her essays are really powerful, and she has some lines about fear that are about as gospel as it comes. And, you know, in the recent 2 years that we've lived through together here in Charlottesville, I definitely have found some of the pieces in Dr. King's Where Do We Go From Here to be very rich and prophetic and timely. I think a lot of us are asking, so where do we go from here? And I think he saw some things that we need to see again. So
I haven't read that. I'll have to read that.
Yeah.
Have you read the new Leaf? How do you say his last name?
Inger.
Mm-hmm. Have you read his new one?
Virgil. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was it good?
Yeah. Leaf's just a fabulous writer.
Yeah.
You know, some writers you read because the story they tell, some writers you read because the sentences they write.
Yes.
And there were multiple times in Virgil where I was just, I underlined it and I thought, darn you, Leaf.
I totally get it. Sometimes it's hard for me to read when I'm actually writing. If right. I'm reading a really good writer.
Yeah.
It just, it pierces me, but also in a good way, but also like, oh man, I want to write like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Completely.
For sure.
Well, let's talk about Eugene Peterson, because you talked about him like first name basis, because you were on a first name basis with him. You were friends with Eugene Peterson. How did you become friends with him?
Well, I guess 20 years ago or so, I read Working the Angles, and immediately I was dumbstruck, filled with hope. I think that was definitely one of those occasions where all of a sudden I had a language for something that I had been scratching after but didn't quite know.
Yes.
And I read Eugene and I felt immediately like, yes, you know, there's a deep resonance. And so at one point I badgered a publisher until they coughed up Eugene's mailing address. And because he didn't have email at the time, he only got email right toward the end of his life, basically only emailed his family, a few other people who found their way. But he was an absolute, like, I mean, he could not email. He couldn't remember how to hit send most of the time. So most of his correspondence, and it was massive, was done the old-fashioned way, mailing letters. And so I mailed him a letter. I don't remember exactly all the timing, but at some point, and it was early on, he and his son Eric were going to teach at a spiritual renewal weekend for a small Presbyterian church in Juneau, Alaska. And I had a friend who, that was her church, and she was a writer. She was actually going to be away for the week and offered me her condo to come and have a retreat. And it was perfect. I don't really like big conferences. And this was this was in a little church, no frills, you know, old pews, hymnals. So I went there. I had written him a letter and said, hey, if I come to Alaska, will you have breakfast with me? And he called me on the phone and I answered, and it felt like I was talking to Moses, you know.
Yeah.
And he had this scratchy voice. Man, this is Eugene Peterson. Anyway, so we had breakfast, and I just waylaid him with an ungodly amount of questions. And then we just kept up from there writing letters, and I saw him, I don't know, I saw him a time or two, but mostly it was letters. And then I became his biographer and spent, you know, the last year and a half of his life, a lot of time with him and Jan in their home. And yeah, it was really beautiful.
How does one become a biographer of a person? Did you just ask him if you could write a book about him?
Well, I'd gone to see him, which I thought would be the last time I would see him. I knew his health was declining and that he just was becoming less and less open, you know, have less space for people and drawing his circle very tight. That would have been toward the end of 2016. And I just, began to think about his end of his life and think about his, someone was going to write his biography. And I started thinking about what my hopes would be for what that biography would look like and the kind of person that would write it. And then I was talking to one of my good friends who's an editor, and he's like, Lynn, you really need to ask him. And I was like, he's not interested in having a biography written about him. It's like, I know, but you'll probably regret it if you don't. So I sent him a letter. We started a conversation. True to form, he wasn't interested, but asked a few questions. As we continued talking, he said, you know what, Lynn, this really feels important to me. I think we should do this. Because I was only interested in it if I had full access to his,
right,
you know, letters and journals and books and thinking and conversations and all that, family. And so, yeah, so I think I just asked, and I've been told no about 100 things. So, but this is just one where they said yes. So
that is amazing. I cannot. Well, have you started writing it?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I researched it for about a year and a half with interviews and stuff. And in October, basically, is when I started writing.
Okay. Okay. So do you know yet when it will be published?
2020 at some point.
Okay.
That's the tentative deadline now.
Okay. I can't wait to read that one. You are the perfect person to write this book.
Oh, thank you.
I feel like you, the way that you write and who you are reminds me of him.
Hmm.
I love Eugene Peterson's writing. I feel the same as you. Like, I resonate. Mm-hmm. I resonate with his writing. And he just says things that I've never been able to put words to, and I immediately can relate. And and so I'm thankful you're writing this, and I'm excited about it.
Oh, me too.
I would love to know what you learned from him. Like, what are some of the main things that stick out that he taught you about pastoring?
You know, it's kind of hard to say, because I think what's most potent about Eugene is not and was not like particular things he said or taught or believed. It was much more the way he was in the world.
Mm-hmm.
He said only a tiny portion of what he actually thought. Most of us do exactly the opposite. We say way more than we actually believe or know. He was very reticent to give advice. People came to him for advice all the time. He didn't much like giving advice. He was very concerned about holding a kind of guru status in the church.
Yeah.
And it was because he did have some real convictions about humility, but I think beyond that, he really believed in the ongoing action of Christ through the Holy Spirit. And he believed that we are always and forever tempted to follow people.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want to contribute to the particular American penchant for following celebrities.
Yeah.
In many regards, though, he in his heart really was an ascetic and a monk. I mean, one of the reasons why he went back to left Regent and went back to Montana was he was very concerned for his own soul, mm-hmm, of what it would do to him to continually be in a place where he was revered so much.
Mm-hmm.
So all that to say, I mean, there are lots of things Eugene believed and taught me. I mean, the things that we would all know, like being committed to your local church. Don't think in the abstract, that Jesus always goes personal, relational, that Christian faith is always communal. It's always an ongoing action of God that we are responding to. God is always the actor. We're always the responder. I mean, all these kinds of things. Resistance to our obsession with image and large and personality, and how these are not just cultural problems, that these are theological problems because they reject the way of Jesus. But what I most got from Eugene was the way he operated in the world. So to be in his home was really to enter another frequency. I don't know how else to say it. He saw the world in a way that most of us don't. He knew something of God that I wish I knew, and I hope that someday I might. But if I'm honest, I just don't.
Hmm.
I can watch him and be thankful and grateful and But he was just aware of the presence of God in ways that I'm not. And I think what that translates to is the language he would use a lot is a biblical imagination. And I think a lot of us, you know, along the way have picked up that language. I'm not sure we have the first clue what that means. And for Eugene, it's something that can't be defined. It can only be lived. And the way I've encountered it is, as I've been reading his journals, Eugene used biblical language in a way that placed him in the story. And so it wasn't something that he was utilizing as a technique or to try to explain something. For instance, I was reading his journal yesterday, and he was just talking about some of his early years and how he was living in the days of Joseph in Egypt. And what that meant for him was, like Joseph, he was in exile, confused, uncertain. But for him, the biblical world was the large world, and he continually was finding his place in it. Hmm. So for him, he was always sort of finding a biblical language that corresponded to his own life, and he lived out of that. And so for what that means for me is that Eugene didn't use the Bible, he lived in it. Hmm. And I think even that phrase can be misunderstood, but there's just something about the way God ordered his world that I found to be very formative for me.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure it's affected your writing as well. I'm sure you've learned a lot from him and taken, I mean, you're a different person and you're going to write differently, but are there things that you have learned or picked up from him?
Do you mean like technique wise?
Yeah. Or anything that you've learned from him?
I probably hyphenate words more than I should, because I mean, you've noticed how he creates words, right? Like next time you're reading him, just pay attention to like whenever he hyphenates words, he'll totally make stuff up. You know, like he'll make a new word that doesn't exist by putting two words together, which kind of goes back to that, the creative power of words. He felt quite free to do that. It's hard. I think his imaginative, reverential yet playful way of engaging scripture, I think it's, he modeled something for me in that.
Mm-hmm. How did you get started writing?
My mom gave me, I don't know if you remember those old Sanger typewriters that were flat and went in a box, like a traveling salesman
yes.
would carry them along, those portable ones. So my mom gave me one when I was probably second grade. It probably was made in the 50s. And I guess she knew somehow. And I immediately began to write my memoir. It was, in fact, I found it going through some of my parents' stuff a couple years ago, and it was in a Garfield folder.
Oh.
And it was on onion skin typewriter paper. It was a half page. It was my life, Wynn Collier. And I got half page in and I was done. I had no more material.
Yeah. That's so funny. A lot happens when you're, how old were you, 10?
Probably.
Yeah.
Like that, yeah.
But how did you know, okay, this is something writing wise that I want to pursue this. I want to give my time to sitting down and learning the craft of writing and, you know, and then going on to pursue publishing. How did that all start for you?
I think from that moment on, even in school, in junior high school, I always enjoyed English. I enjoyed the times where we were to write. I went to college, and very few of the courses I was in actually were creative in any way. But I remember there was like one course where the professor, it was a theology course, and the professor just gave us free rein. And I totally like created, I can't even remember, some fiction story that like, and this, you know, these guys loved it. And I just remember, you know, just like, this is what I want to do. And probably 2001, we moved to Clemson, South Carolina. And my first son was being born. It felt like lots of new things were emerging. And that was when I just made a commitment. I was like, I have to pursue this. And so I wrote for free for a magazine for, I don't know, a couple years, and can kind of trace back to that decision to do that for free to most everything I've done since. I mean, a couple of publishers, you know, reached out to me and just started to build some friendships, and that's how it started.
Yeah. Was it relevant
It was relevant. Yeah.
I remember reading that when this was before you moved to Charlottesville. I remember reading you in Relevant.
Yeah.
That's so funny. I hadn't thought of that before, but.
And I was so unrelevant.
Well, another fun fact is that as I was trying to pursue writing, I asked to meet with you and we sat down in what is now Grit. I don't even remember what it used to be.
Cafe Cubano.
Okay. And we sat down and I asked you a bunch of questions and you gave me your time and you gave me your advice and it was helpful. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, you've done great.
Well, I'm thankful for the opportunity to do it, but it's hard. Writing is hard.
It is. That's right.
Yeah. So I would love for you to tell listeners, there are a lot of people out there think, you know, I would like to write, or I don't know where to begin. I don't even remember the specifics of what you said to me that day, but what would you say to those people who are like me coming to you for advice?
I think it is kind of hard to give blanket advice because it's such a writing, such a personal thing.
Yeah.
And finding your own voice. And I mean, I think the sort of cliche responses in some respects are just hard won wisdom. Like, you know, read a lot, write a lot. Don't be afraid. It's kind of tricky because I think there's a difference between someone saying, I really want to write, and someone saying, I really want to be published.
Yeah.
So that can be kind of tricky because that one can be more about the ego. And there's a lot of people who get published that aren't very good writers. So those are two really different tracks. But at the same time, I also don't buy into the wisdom that says, hey, just write for yourself. I don't know. I don't do much of anything just for myself. I do lots of things. I want to share it. You know, mm-hmm. I have something I believe in and I want to, and oftentimes to be creative is to offer something to give away.
Right.
So there's all that, but I think I would just say, find some people that you can work with, that can be honest with you and commit to a decade of writing and then see where you are in a decade.
Hmm. Nobody liked what you just said right there. Everybody wants it to happen quickly. I mean,
yeah, me too. Yeah.
But you're right. It does. It's a lot of years of learning and growing and working, and you don't know what's going to come from it, but.
Yeah. And what other profession in some ways, okay, I'm going to sound like an old codger here, but what other things would we expect to say, I can just start doing it and immediately I'm going to be a professional at it?
That's true.
In some ways, it can be a diminishing of the vocation to think such a thing.
Yeah.
And if anybody can just do it, then what is it worth doing? But this is something that's going to require work and rejection. I mean, I had a decade of absolute rejection. And even now, I mean, majority of my books have not sold very well. And so in some ways, I'm having to continually recreate this. But man, if you love it, you can't do anything else.
Yeah. So you love it. You love writing.
Oh, it's part of who I am. Yeah. It's not something I do.
Yeah. It just comes out.
I mean, it's hard work. I don't act like it's natural, but I mean, I couldn't not do it. Yeah, it's part of my way in the world, of how I process the world.
Yes, exactly. That's how I feel too. I don't really know what I think until I've written it down.
Mm-hmm.
So I learn a lot from writing.
Yeah.
But what are the hard parts about it for you?
Well, like most of us, you know, it's really hard to try to do the marketing game.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't have this sort of sense of like, I'm too good for that. I shouldn't have to. But I mean, it's hard when what feels, and I'm speaking for myself, I'm not saying this is true for everyone, but just my personality, my convictions, that sort of thing. It's hard when in the current environment, what's often expected for you to do in order to be successful is itself contrary to the message that you're bringing. So, yes. So for instance, it's very much, this is a connection back to Eugene. He talks over and over and over again about how we must have congruence between ways and means, that your message actually is inevitably embedded in the way you speak. So, you know, as Christians, we can't say God is love and then act like hellions. Right. Those things cancel one another out. So to be someone who feels like the voice you have to offer is one of thoughtfulness, spaciousness, humility, listening as much as speaking, you know, slow, to feel like sometimes what you're required to do is contrary to that, feels disingenuous and counter. So what that means is we don't get to opt out, because, you know, publishers we'll often find are actually no better at marketing than we are. So we have to find, what are the genuine, truthful ways that I can offer my message and my voice? And then I'm going to have to trust God to make up the difference, you know?
Yeah.
So we do things like have podcasts with friends. and like, okay, yeah, this feels genuine. I can have a conversation. Sure, I can do that.
Yeah. So I also wonder if you feel the tension between being a pastor, a full-time pastor, and then your writing. I don't know how many hours a week you work on that, but that would seem like a tension to me. But do you see it as being together or separate?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I've often said I'm a pastor writer, just like, you know, there's an older model for pastor theologians where these two things are congruent. They can't be separated. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely true for me. I think writing is some of how I process even like how I'm thinking as a pastor to pastor our church.
Mm-hmm.
Writing is some of what I give away as a pastor. So, and sometimes it's the lines are kind of fuzzy between like how these things are distinct.
Yeah.
At the same time, from a practical standpoint, I don't have a lot of time for writing. So, you know, thankfully our church values and values me being the pastor that I am, and I am allowed to integrate these things. But, you know, logistically, I have a very set number of hours a week I can give to this, and the rest is taken up by other pastoral work and duties. So that is frustrating. In general, I would say has not been frustrating. I am finding it a little difficult in this particular project with Eugene's book, just because it's research at a whole nother level.
Yes.
But what it's teaching me is just my limits.
Mm.
And I think there would be a temptation for me to research and just knowing, you know, I can't do that. I have this limited amount of time that's available to me. No, I'm not a full-time biographer. So this is what I have. And
right.
So it probably requires me to be creative. It requires me to stop, and it also requires me to edit, you know, which is always a good thing.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your latest book, Love Big, Be Well. It, to me, when I read it, it seemed like I could pick out Charlottesville and I could pick out you and All Souls, your church in it, but it was not. It's a fiction book. Tell us about it first. For those who haven't read it, tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah. So Jonas McCann is a pastor who's been without a church for a while, had some dark moments in his story. Granby Presbyterian Church has been without a pastor for a while. They've had some troubles, and they find one another actually through letters. And then after Jonas becomes the pastor at Granby, he continues for the next 7 years to write occasional letters to his congregation. And so it's an epistolary novel and takes the shape of these letters. And in it, he narrates stories in the congregation, walks through his life with them. And then it ends, I'll just stop there. Yeah.
It seemed a little bit autobiographical. Is that the right, how do you say that? Autobiographical to me.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it was kind of your, maybe like a pastoral letter that you would write to your own church? Some of these letters that the pastor's writing in the book?
Yeah. I mean, definitely there's a lot of me in Jonas. Jonas is not me, and it's not autobiographical, but there's no way a pastor is going to write a character of a pastor, at least one that's, you know, decent and moral and not a goofball, total goofball, without him being poured into it. So yes, I mean, there definitely was a lot of my sensibilities about pastoring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's what I meant mostly, is just, I can see your philosophy of pastoring come through that book?
Yeah, I think what's tricky for me in the answer to that question is, I mean, to not be coy, the answer is yes, that is true. And I'm glad you saw that because I liked Jonas. And,
yeah.
But I think why I'm hesitant is it was very important to me that this book be true fiction and not just be like a tract, sort of yes. using fiction as a guise to get across another point, you know, like a parable or something. Like, that's not how I thought about it. Mm-hmm. So however you could take those two things and just throw them in together, that's what I was hoping to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought it was a really good book. It seemed yeah. like it got some traction. Do you feel like people were responding to it? How yeah. you hoped? Yeah.
Well, no, I hope to be a New York Times bestseller.
right.
But yeah, and interesting that it seems like one of those books that sort of hits a little pocket of different parts of the church and different geographical areas and different denominations at different times. And
yeah.
So that's been fun.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed it.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
And I can't wait to read the Eugene Peterson one.
Yeah.
But I would love to close just talking about being a pastor and what are the joys for you of being a pastor? And maybe for those people who are listening who they don't know what it's like to be a pastor, they don't know what it's like to be in the family of someone, a wife of a pastor, what would you say the joys of pastoring are, and what are some of the challenges for you in your work?
Yeah, that's a thoughtful question. Thank you. I think the joys are that you get to be a herald of the true story of the world. And we get to speak those words like hope and faith and joy and love and mercy. I mean, one of the most holy times for me in the week is on Sundays, both right before I stand up to preach. In our liturgy, the words I speak to the congregation before a sermon is just the basic greeting, grace and peace of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ to each of you. And they respond, and also with you. And whenever I'm in another place that doesn't have that practice, I find my heart missing that interchange of me speaking a blessing to them and them speaking a blessing back to me. And Marilynne Robinson says that a sermon is when one person is trying to have a conversation in good faith with a community of persons. And I really love that. And then right before we send people out, I invite people to put their hands out, put their palms up, and I get a chance to speak a blessing over our church. And what other places do you get to look people in the eyes and remind them that they are the beloved of God? You know, that's a powerful thing.
That is.
And what other place do you get a chance to look someone and with the full conviction of the Trinity say, you are not alone. Your story is not end in death, you know? And so to me, that's beautiful. And to walk alongside people in their pain, to receive people's wounds, to remind people of the new creation that God is making happen around us. And that is the truth of the world. I think what's hard is, and this may be different for different personalities and different kinds of pastors. I mean, I think it's really essential for all of us. It's certainly essential for pastors if we are leading the way to Sabbath, draw boundaries, that sort of thing. But no matter how well you Sabbath or how many boundaries you draw, I think if you are a true pastor, it's something that you are. It's not something that you do. And that's not something that you can turn off. Mm-hmm. So you never stop being a pastor. And no matter what relationship you're in, and you might be lots of other things, you know, you might be friend or fellow dad or disciple or whatever, but you're also a pastor. And, you know, that's why I'm a huge believer in taking like your whole, as much of your chunk of vacation time as you can at once, because I need extended times for me to feel like I'm not, you know, I'm not a pastor for a little while.
Yeah.
I think trying to discern how to pastor people who are really different can be really hard. You know, people along the political spectrum, the theological spectrum, and wanting to be faithful at the same time, wanting to be careful and open and generous and being full aware that I probably don't get it right a lot of times and having to trust God's mercy even in that. So yeah, that's a couple of things where I go first of all.
Yeah, that's good. Well, when I'm thankful for you and what you're doing, and I just feel like you speak words. I'm thinking back to when we had the August 12th, a year later, we all gathered downtown where the events happened in Charlottesville that everyone's familiar with from the news. And you spoke a prayer. You prayed for us. And that's what I remember from that day. I do feel like your words are a ministry to our community, and they are a ministry through in your church, but not just in your church, in our community as a whole. And through your writing, they go out. And I'm thankful for that. I'm thankful for what you're doing in our community and how you're serving. And I just encourage you to keep going.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. It's kind.
And thank you for your time today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Friends, thank you so much for listening to By Faith. It's such a joy for me personally to have these kinds of conversations, especially with somebody I know in real life like Wynn. But I also love creating this podcast for you. If you're encouraged or helped in some way, I would love for you to share the podcast on social media using the hashtag #ByFaithPodcast. Tag me too so I can see what you're saying about it. Thanks so much in advance for doing that. Join me next week as I talk with my friend, Trillia Newbell. Trillia is a huge ray of sunshine. Seriously, her smile lights up any room she's in. Trillia joins me to talk about women and fear. If you've been following along this season and thinking more about your own gifts, but you're also feeling unsure and insecure about stepping out and using them, this conversation is for you. So join me here next week, and until then, have a great week and keep walking forward by faith.